two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Happy 2024! New year, new you, right? Let me guess. You're thinking about joining a new gym, starting a fad diet, buying that Theragun everyone's always yammering on about. I've got a better idea. Listen to my podcast. I'm Samantha Bee, writer, comedian, and host of Choice Words from Lemonada Media. This whole month of January, we're going to help you make better choices in 2024. We'll go beyond superficial hacks and get at the truth of how to lead a more meaningful life. Just search for Choice Words on your podcast player of choice and hit follow so you don't miss an episode. Now that is a good choice.
Lemonada.
Bubbleheads is senior producer Kyle Sheely coming at you here. Before we start the interview today, I just want to let you know that the team has put together a special surprise for Andy, and you're definitely going to want to stick around to the end of the show when we present it to him. Maybe skip to the end. It's pretty great, I got to admit. Personally, I listen all the way through. I know all of you do too. But just in case today, it's Friday, maybe you're going to knock off a little early, only listen to 80% of the interview. I get that, but no, not today. Today, you're going to have to listen to the whole thing. I promise you it's worth it. Or skip to the end and then come right back and listen to the interview. If you can't wait for a surprise, then nobody would blame you for that. But otherwise, absolutely worth your time to check out the end of the interview and hear our special gift to Andy at the end of the show. And so without further ado, I'm going to hand it over to Andy.
This is In the Bubble with Andy Slavitt. Welcome. And don't forget, you can email me at andy@lemonadamedia.com. Cheryl Gay Stolberg is on the show today. She has been the primary beat reporter covering COVID and the White House from Washington for the New York Times since April of 2020. She has written some of the best and most compelling pieces. She's a tough interviewer. She's interviewed me before. I wouldn't say that the stuff she writes is always super flattering, but what she writes has always been very incisive, and I think she really has an eye and a mind towards explaining things for people in a way that makes it so much easier to understand. We're going to dig into some of the controversies and the politicization of COVID with a particular focus on this origin story, which she has a very clean and clear way of explaining to people. Occasionally on this show, we will have a guest who will explain a complex matter in a really, really simple way, better than I've heard anywhere else before. And Cheryl does that here on this interview, so I think you're going to appreciate that. By the way, when that happens, it's usually not due to me. It's usually because we just have the right guest on the topic. And so I suppose that's more due to the production team than it is to me. But in this case, Cheryl, I think, rocks it. I think you'll really like this. So let's bring her on. Cheryl, welcome to the bubble.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
The tables turn, haven't they? I've been your source before, and now I get to interview you.
That's right. I don't know what it's like on the other end, Andy. We'll see.
It's easier to be interviewed than interview, I think. I really have so much admiration for what it takes to interview someone successfully, having now tried to do it. I found it much easier to be interviewed, because then you can just say what you need to say.
Yeah, I think that's true. When you're doing an interview, you have to spin things out in your head as you're talking.
Yeah. But so my approach here is just get into a conversation, because I don't have much talent for anything else, but I know how to talk. And if I talk to interesting people like you, it often works. You wrote an interesting piece about how the discussion around where COVID came from has sort of had this sort of kind of distorted political lens over it. Maybe we could just start with what the state of play is. I think it's confusing for people when they see one government agency says one thing, some scientists say another thing, and then everyone else says, well, we're not really sure. Like, what is the state of play?
Well, I think it is confusing, but there are two primary theories about where COVID came from. One is that it emerged from the Huanan seafood market in Wuhan, China, that it was natural in origin, that maybe a bat, bats are known to harbor coronaviruses, maybe a bat transmitted it to an animal and an animal transmitted it to a human. But then there's this other theory, and the other theory is that the coronavirus emerged from a lab, specifically from the Wuhan Institute of Virology, which is a premier coronavirus research lab right there in Wuhan. And what we're seeing is, frankly, fights between scientists and also between politicians about where this thing came from.
And at this point, am I correct that all the evidence is pretty much circumstantial, or do we have anything better than that?
So I think it depends on how you define evidence, right? Like there is some evidence that the virus was natural in origin. Just last week or so, some researchers found samples of raccoon dogs that were being sold in this market. They had genetic samples of this virus, and it matched the virus in humans. And there have been other studies showing that, for instance, Laotian bats have the capability to infect human cells in much the same way as SARS-CoV-2 does. So you might call that more than circumstantial evidence. Mm. It's genetic evidence, but it's not conclusive genetic evidence. Mm. On the other side, for the lab leak theory, there is circumstantial evidence. There's a couple of things that are really troubling. One is that in 2018, a group called the EcoHealth Alliance, which is a nonprofit that has been funded by the U.S. government and has worked with the Wuhan Institute, they put forth a proposal for an experiment. They asked our Defense Department to fund this experiment that would have basically manufactured a virus that looks very much like what SARS-CoV-2 wound up looking like. So that proposal wasn't funded. But a lot of people are saying, wow, like if they were going to engineer this virus and they had proposed doing this exact thing and then boom, the next year later, you know, it shows up and it's maybe the Wuhan Institute did that experiment after all. We don't know. There's other questions about the Institute. We know from our own State Department that the Institute was working on secret projects with the Chinese military. What were those projects? We don't know what they were. So I would say there is circumstantial evidence for the lab leak that is inconclusive. There's genetic evidence for the market theory or the natural origins theory that's inconclusive.
Well, you make my job so easy. You just explained it clearer than I've even understood it before. And I've read some of these reports. But I want to go into the lab leak theory again for a second, because I hear that different ways. Like I hear some people, when they talk about a lab leak, talking about it as a rather innocent accident. And of course, the image you have in your mind is like someone spills a test tube, like in a Bugs Bunny cartoon or something. And then, you know, someone goes home to their family and, you know, exposes somebody. The way you just described it sounds a bit more potentially sinister, like perhaps that it was purposely engineered. Which of those is an accurate sort of portrayal?
So, yeah, I want to then clarify. I think there's three ways that a lab leak could possibly have happened. One could be an intentional engineering with the intent to harm, with the intent to hurt people. That's really not what I was referring to, and most experts completely discount the idea that this was manufactured as a bioweapon.
Okay.
But researchers also tinker with viruses quite legitimately in order to figure out ways to counteract them, to prepare for the event that a virus could mutate and become very infectious. So there would be legitimate reasons for doing the kind of research I described, to maybe figure out what it would take for a virus to become a virus that could be a deadly pathogen, and then figure out ways to prevent that. Separate and apart from all of that, This lab studied viruses, and it's quite possible that in its collection, perhaps, it had a sample of SARS-CoV-2 unknowingly, maybe collected from a bat, and that virus itself, pre-existing virus, a virus that was natural in origin, infected a lab worker. The lab worker goes out into the community and, you know, boom, you've got a pandemic. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And I find myself thinking of this as a bit of a Rorschach test. Like, what kind of belief system do you have can kind of indicate which of these theories seems more attractive? Because as you say, one of them has some genetic evidence, but not conclusive. The other has a story you can paint around circumstantial evidence. Can you talk about perhaps who sort of seems to be leading proponents of each of those theories? And, you know, perhaps comment on whether or not, you know, there are other things at work causing people to believe one versus the other?
There are two camps of the two camps. And by what I mean by that is we can talk about the scientists and we can also talk about the politicians. So when we talk about the scientists, there's a group of virologists who strongly believe that this was natural in origin. And I would put in that camp Tony Fauci. He has said repeatedly that he believes the preponderance of evidence is that the pandemic was natural in origin, although he has said he's open to the idea of a lab leak.
He does say he doesn't know.
He does say he doesn't know.
He says he doesn't know, and then he said if that's where he would speculate.
Right. And so there are other virologists, like someone named Michael Warraby, a virologist in Arizona, who's done a lot of this research. Others, I'm thinking of Angie Rasmussen and a few others who have really done this genetic research and believe firmly that their work shows that the virus is natural in origin. Then there's this whole other group of scientists, not necessarily virologists, but some of them biologists or prominent people like David Relman at Stanford and Richard Ebright at Rutgers. These are serious academics who strongly argue that the virus could have leaked from a lab and that it's really important that we don't discount that, that we look into it at least, and that we be intellectually honest about what we don't know. And then you overlay American politics over that. And what happened was President Trump, when he was in office, embraced this lab leak theory and said, well, you know, we're looking into whether it came from a lab. And reporters said to him, well, how do you know that, sir? And he said, well, I'm not allowed to tell you. Well, in our hyper-polarized climate, immediately Democrats and journalists, frankly, started pushing back on that. So now you had not only a scientific debate, but also a political debate where you had Trump on the one side embracing the lab leak. Democrats said, oh, that's just Trump trying to distract from his failings, his administration's failings in controlling spread of the virus. And it's nuts. And we think that, you know, it's clearly market in origins.
In other words, even people who lie a lot occasionally will say something that's not a lie. And I said it. I said it, not you.
I think that I would cast it differently. I think that he said something that was plausible without evidence for it. He had a history of saying things that lacked evidence. And so therefore, many people were naturally suspicious.
You said it more precisely, and which is why you're such a great reporter for The New York Times. Let me do a quick break and come right back and talk about this political overlay a little bit more.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
People love to pretend that there are simple formulas for living your best life now. Eat this and you won't get sick. Manifest it and everything will work out. But there are some things you can choose and some things you can't. And it's okay that life isn't always getting better. I'm Kate Bowler, and on Everything Happens, I speak with kind, smart, funny people about life as it really is. Beautiful, terrible, and everything in between. Let's be human together. Everything Happens is available wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. Yeah, so it's interesting both that, like, Trump, who often went off half-cocked without evidence, said something which seemed politically expedient, i.e. this isn't my fault. And then the anti-Trump reaction, you know, is equally interesting because there's such a sort of automatic response when he says something that looks like he's deferring blame. Now that he's out of office, where's the political center of gravity on this issue? Are politicians feeling like this is an issue that has some kind of political juice in it?
My colleague Benjamin Mueller and I reported that there was really a concerted effort on the part of those who believed in the lab leak theory, or those who at least wanted it investigated, to persuade policymakers and journalists and lawmakers that they needed to take this idea seriously. And I think when President Biden was elected, that started to happen. Jamie Metzl, who is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and had worked in the Clinton White House, met with the president's incoming national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, in December of 2020, right before President Biden took office, and said, hey, you know, you got to take this seriously, laid out a case for it. And then we saw President Biden himself, in May of 2021, order an intelligence review, asking the intelligence community to investigate the cause of the pandemic, you know, wherever it might lead. And that really opened the door for Democrats to start thinking about this in a much more open-minded way.
And what did the various intelligence agencies have to say? And remind us that there was a report from the Department of Energy. It seems like there are a few different agencies with a dog in this race, so to speak. And that in of itself, I think, is confusing to people.
Right. So that report that Biden asked for, it was a 90-day inquiry, and it came to mixed conclusions. And it had a handful of intelligence agencies. And these are like the Defense Department has an intelligence branch, and you know, other departments, the Energy Department that you mentioned, Homeland Security, the FBI, most of them, or four of them at least, said that they thought the virus was natural in origin. One of them, the FBI at that time, said they thought it could be a lab leak. The big granddaddy of intelligence agencies, the CIA, was agnostic, didn't take a position one way or the other. So there was really no conclusion. And then more recently, the Energy Department changed its conclusion and said that it had concluded with low confidence that the pandemic was likely the result of a laboratory accident. And I think accident is a word that we should actually be thinking about.
Sure.
Because
sure.
When we're talking about a lab leak, we are talking about an accident, not an intentional act.
And did they have anything beyond the circumstantial data evidence that you described that led them to change their point of view?
So we don't know what their evidence is, but we may find out because the House and Senate both have passed unanimously a bill called the COVID Origins Act, which instructs intelligence community to declassify intelligence relating to the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And this past week, President Biden signed it into law. They have 90 days to release it. It'll get vetted first by the Director of National Intelligence before anything gets released. But the public will, I guess, at least get to see the information that these agencies relied on.
So I recall in the hearings last year, Rand Paul questioning Tony Fauci in some pretty memorable exchanges. They get pretty spicy.
If the point that you are making is that the grant that was funded as a sub-award from EcoHealth to Wuhan created SARS-CoV-2, that's where you are getting. Let me finish.
We don't know.
Well,
we don't
wait
know
a minute.
If it did come from the lab, but all the evidence is pointing that it came from the lab, and there will be responsibility for those who funded the lab, including yourself. I totally resent the lie that you are now propagating, Senator.
Okay, so what's going on here? It feels like there is a lot of innuendo that Senator Paul is pressing Dr. Fauci on, and Dr. Fauci obviously is getting a little bit exasperated just by the implications that seem to be coming his way.
So this is a debate that is kind of a cousin of the COVID origins debate, and it's about gain of function research. And gain of function research is research that might take a virus and change its properties in a way that could make it more infectious. Just like we talked about before, maybe for the purpose of figuring out a vaccine or some way to counteract a highly infectious virus. So Senator Paul has been accusing Dr. Fauci and his institute, his former institute, of funding gain-of-function research at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. There are very specific definitions for gain-of-function research, and Dr. Fauci has said consistently, no, we did not fund gain-of-function research. We never funded that kind of work. And to a certain extent, it's splitting hairs, because the U.S., through the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases, did fund some research at the Wuhan Institute of Virology with this EcoHealth Alliance group. The NIH maintains that none of that research could have led to SARS-CoV-2, that the genetics of the viruses that were being studied with U.S. government funding bear no resemblance at all to the virus that causes COVID-19. But nonetheless, you're right. Senator Paul has been really hammering Dr. Fauci on this and extrapolating to accuse him, in effect, of, causing the whole pandemic. And other Republicans have picked up on that. People on, the Fauci-hating wing of the Republican Party,
right?
Jim Jordan, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and others have sort of picked up on this theme to try to accuse Dr. Fauci of some, nefarious deeds for which there is no evidence.
Is there political traction for those Republicans and for the Republicans in general to press this point?
So I think that's really interesting. And I think it really actually speaks to the split in the Republican Party. And so it clearly is a political weapon for the far right, for the MAGA crowd, who have, made a lot of hay out of attacking Dr. Fauci. We've seen Ron DeSantis in Florida run ads about Fauci. Other candidates have, signed on to the Fire Fauci movement. Of course, he's already retired, so you can't fire him. But I think that there is an element of the Republican Party that does want to seriously consider this. And I think we're actually seeing that. Maybe I'm naive and maybe overly hopeful, but I think we are seeing that a little bit in these hearings that the House Select Subcommittee on the Coronavirus Pandemic is holding. So yes, there's, Jim Jordan railing against Fauci and saying all of these, hyperbolic things. But also Brad Wenstrup, who's the chair of that committee, has worked very closely and, collaboratively with Raul Ruiz, who's the Democratic ranking member. And they both seem to want to have a thoughtful discussion of this. And I guess the question in my mind is, can they keep the right and the left, you know, the far right and the far left at bay? And I, you know, I don't know the answer to that yet. I don't think we, you know, we have seen enough to know.
Not a ton of evidence yet. Let's take one final break, Cheryl. We'll come back and talk about some of the other latest things happening with COVID.
Hi, I'm June Diane Raphael.
And I'm Jessica St. Clair.
And each week we are sitting down to talk all about life's twists, turns, and absurdities on The Deep Dive.
From exploring the depths of TikTok, which is our only news source, to navigating the complexities of grief and loss, we are just two best friends behind a mic processing life together.
This podcast is all about finding the silver linings in the madness. So get ready for unfiltered conversations about motherhood, careers, pop culture, and everything in between.
Here at The Deep Dive, we're all about community. We believe in the power of sharing experiences and the strength that comes from supporting one another. And we would love to have you with us.
So be sure to join us every Wednesday on The Deep Dive from Lemonada Media, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Dough, where cash is queen and we hardly know her, but we're still here figuring her out together because, y'all, season two is here. Hosted every week by me, X Maya. Remember me? I'm going to be talking to all types of people about their relationship to money. I'm talking to reality stars, entrepreneurs, financial experts, and even some of my own friends. Basically, anyone who will get real with me about their dollars, how they make money, how they spend it, and how they save it, because I'm trying to retire early, people. Season two of The Dough is out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, you've been covering COVID as a main reporter for the New York Times for how long now? Since the outset, right?
Not exactly since the outset. I was actually covering Congress at the outset, but I have a background as a health policy writer. And so in April of 2020, the leadership of the Times asked me if I would go back to writing about health policy. And that's where I've been ever since.
What a ride that must have been.
It's been really interesting and rewarding, and I really feel like it's actually a privilege to be able to do this work and try to educate the public as best we can.
Look, I think my experience with you, as I've said at the beginning of the show, I've been interviewed by you, I've probably been in maybe one or two of your stories here and there, is that you do a very good job shining a light on the things the public needs to know. And when I was in the White House, I viewed it as a really important connection to the public to be able to provide more transparency that had been provided before. I'm curious if your reflections, as we're hitting, I think, a real milestone, this end of the national public health emergency, on what you think some of the most interesting stories, whether or most interesting events that have occurred over this kind of very meaningful period of time.
Wow. I try to think of what we've learned. You know, one of the things we've learned is, I think, something Dr. Fauci would tell you, which is never underestimate a virus, right? Like, you well remember in the summer of 2021, and we thought that, you know, this pandemic was in the rearview mirror. I even wrote a line I regret, you know, as the pandemic appears to be in the rearview mirror. And then, you know, we were whacked with the Delta variant. Some of the really important stories, I think, that have come out are the stories about our lack of preparedness for this pandemic, stories about the importance of public health officials and workers in our society, the incredibly brave doctors and first responders who, in those early days of the pandemic, were caring for people without, you know, proper gear, and, you know, many of them dying as a result. I think about the orphans, the COVID orphans that I've written about, kids who are, you know, lost one parent or more to the pandemic. I think a lot about misinformation and how that has played a role. I wrote a story maybe 6 months or so ago about a guy named Randy Watt, who was not a COVID denier, but wouldn't get vaccinated, got COVID, treated himself with ivermectin, and died. And the grief that his family experienced. He had sort of gone down the rabbit hole on a social media platform called Gab, a Christian nationalist platform. And just the grief that his family experienced over his death, complicated by the fact that he had, you know, taken in this misinformation, was very, very powerful. And then the whole story that we're discussing right now about the politicization of science, the way we've seen public health in our country get politicized, and the anti-vaccine movement troubles me that we might, going forward, be actually less prepared for the next pandemic simply because of the erosion of faith in public health and because of the pushback against vaccine mandates, including mandates for children, you know, for childhood vaccines.
So true. You know, I have a dividing line in my mind, Cheryl, which is things that happened during the pandemic that were the result of people doing their absolute best. I'm pretty forgiving. Both Democratic Republican governors made mistakes. Both White Houses have made mistakes. CDC has made mistakes. And so long as people, you know, worked hard, worked in good faith, we may feel let down by them. We may feel like we should, you know, people should have done better. But I don't think there was a chance that we were going to get it perfectly right, because it was a very mysterious thing that happened that was without precedent, the way the virus behaved. On the other hand, there were steps taken in bad faith from time to time, and that spilled over to a lot of people and made them feel less prepared and be, in fact, less prepared. You think about, for example, what would have happened if Donald Trump in early 2020, as he claimed to Bob Woodward, was aware of what was going to happen. If he would have simply stood up and said, "Hey, folks, this is something that may be coming at us. We got a problem." How many lives would have been saved? To me, that calculation is an example of one of those occasions of people simply not working in our interests. And I think for the American public, the thing that scares them the most is not whether or not the CDC did a great job, a good job, or a fair job. They obviously hope that we do as good a job as possible. But I think what scares them is people overlaying politics on their lives, on things that affect their lives.
Yeah, I it's funny. You must have been reading my mind, because as you were speaking, before you said Trump's name, I was thinking, imagine a world in which Donald Trump had come out and said, "I'm wearing a mask, and I think all of you should wear masks too." I mean, he could have put his name on the mask. He could have sold Trump masks, you know? Imagine a world in which he had gotten vaccinated on television. The vaccine came and he said, "This is a vaccine. It's a wonderful thing. It's going to save lives. And I'm going to show some leadership by getting vaccinated on television." Now, it's true. Maybe you would have seen Democrats say, "Whoa, no, I'm not going to do that," you know. But I think that the politicization is, frankly, the most troubling aspect to me. And it's because the politics was not in good faith.
Absolutely. You know, I was going to say that when I talk to my counterparts in other countries, they would tell me, in effect, what you just said, which is, this is not easy. This is hard. There are people that don't like wearing masks. There are people that don't believe what we're telling them. There are people who have very different points of view on how we should respond. But the one thing that they said was repeatedly was different was those opinions had nothing to do with their political affiliation. That they didn't have the same level of correlation here, which is, if the color of your jersey is red, there's a prepackaged set of beliefs that you're going to have about masks and about vaccines, perhaps, and other things. And if the color of your jersey is blue, there's another set of beliefs that you're going to have. And it's really a shame. And I don't think the cause of this is COVID. I think that COVID is just the effect. We're just seeing the effect.
It's a symptom
of the division. It's a symptom. That's exactly right. It's a symptom.
But it's a symptom that is it's so serious because lives were lost as a result of this. I mean, we could track, you know, at the height of the pandemic, deaths were higher in counties that voted for President Trump than those that voted for President Biden. Like, how can that be?
No, it's certainly true. And it's also true that there are plenty of Republican governors, save a couple, who were doing their best to prevent deaths, to, you know, balance that with keeping the economy open, with just tough, difficult decisions around schools, et cetera. You know, and they would tell me, as I'm sure they told you, that they didn't feel well served at the time by the president, obviously very dependent on him. So, you know, I think the story is not that a Republican president necessarily had to take the view that he did. If Mitt Romney had been president or George W. Bush had been president,
it would have been a different story.
I think the response would have looked a lot like it looked under Joe Biden.
I think that's right. I think that's absolutely right. You know, if there is one thing to give Donald Trump credit for, it is the Operation Warp Speed, which resulted in a vaccine in record time.
I agree with that. As I said on Fox News, from the South Lawn.
Is that right?
In a moment where I think the Fox and Friends folks thought they had me in a gotcha. But I do think this sort of the spirit of saying everybody who had a hand in a success should get credit is a really important one. And there are a lot of people going back a number of presidencies that have been responsible for investing in the mRNA platform. And the portfolio bet that the Trump administration took, saying we're going to bet on six horses, or I think that was the number, was a very smart bet.
Yeah.
Well, Cheryl, thank you so much for being here. I think you can, listening to this conversation, you can feel no less settled, but certainly you made it a lot clearer how the dividing lines are drawn both in the scientific community and the political community. And I think, again, I thank you for all your work covering this issue, bringing it to the American public.
Well, thank you, Andy, and thank you for your work, too.
Thank you, Cheryl. Hey, did I ever mention to you guys that this week was our third anniversary? I think I might have mentioned it like 50 times. Anyway, we have one more surprise for you. And I want to hand it over to my amazing senior producer, Kyle Sheely.
Yeah. Surprisingly, Andy, I don't know if you had mentioned it, but it turned out the word got out and we fielded a bunch of calls from people this week, past guests and friends of the pod, who wanted to send you a special message of congratulations for this anniversary. So here are, without further ado, are the friends of In the Bubble.
Hi, Andy. This is Bob Wachter.
Hi, Andy. It's David Agus.
Hi, Andy. This is your favorite epidemiologist, Caitlin Jedalina.
Andy Slavitt, podcast host, world improver. It is your friend, Stephanie Whittles-Wax.
Hi, this is Mark Leibovich of The Atlantic, and more to the point, a friend of the bubble. I just wanted to chime in here and wish Andy and the bubble team and the bubble family a happy third-year anniversary of the launch.
I remember getting that email from you. I think it was around 8 p.m. on a Saturday night back in March of 2020, and I think the message was, hey, I need a podcast and I want it like tomorrow and I really only want to make it with Lemonada. It truly was in those early days such a public service.
We've known each other for a long time. And I have to say, when you first invited me on the bubble, I was a little bit reticent. At the time, what was going on with COVID was very political, lots of debate back and forth. And what you said really defined who you were politically rather than who you were as a scientist or a medical doctor or a data person. But I have to say is what you did was really remarkable. You presented the issues, you presented the data in a way that I think made many people in this country feel better.
We all agree that this pandemic has been nothing short of just an absolutely wild ride. And For me, part of that wildness is meeting giants like you who have not only been helping the general public understand what the hell is going on, but asking the experts really hard questions. You are one of the few that really keep me on my toes during podcasts and interviews.
Let me thank you for giving me one of the peak opportunities of my life when I had a chance to step in for a few months to host In the Bubble. During my time there, I came to recognize that your combination of brilliance, empathy, snarkiness, and wit, plus the fact that you somehow know something about everything, made you literally irreplaceable.
Hi, Andy. Mike Osterholm. As I've said to you on multiple occasions, I look to you as my North Star for information. You're someone who is visionary, but you're very practical. You're incredibly trustworthy. When you tell me something, I can take it to the bank.
Whenever I was struck with some sort of what felt like a life and death question, thinking, I need to talk to Andy. I need to turn to Andy.
I am proud to call you a friend. I'm proud of what the bubble has become in your evolution. You have a certain way of attacking things where with some understanding, but humor, and also at the same time, you know, respecting who you talk to.
Hey, Andy, it's Jason Kander. Huge congratulations on the show. You know, I was thinking about it. My appearance on the show wasn't just one of my favorite podcast episodes that I did. It's actually, I think, one of my favorite conversations that I've had this year. It just happened to be that we were recording and other people got to hear it.
Hi, Andy. Jeff, CEO of Lemonada and the biggest In the Bubble fan ever. I just want to thank you all. It's been 3 years of keeping us calm, keeping us safe, making us laugh, dad jokes, best guests on the planet, best host there has ever been. The show has a really special place in our country. Andy, you have done so much for us as listeners, but also as citizens.
Hey, Andy, it's Al Franken. Thank you for having me on as a guest so often. I just have to say what a thrill it is to be on a podcast that's hosted by someone who knows what he's talking about most of the time.
Hey, Dad, this is Zach. I just wanted to congratulate you and the team on 3 years of In the Bubble. I'm happy to see that you guys have continued the show and it's continued to help and inform people. I'm glad we were able to start this together, and I can't wait to see where it goes.
I am very, very glad that it's here because there are way too many podcasts in the world, but not enough good podcasts and even fewer great podcasts. And The Bubble is a rare one of those.
I couldn't feel more grateful that you have been with this network for the last few years, that you have brought your trusted voice to Lemonada and to your audience who absolutely adores you.
Congratulations on In the Bubble's 3-year anniversary.
Thank you for being you. I love you.
So thank you for all of your work on In the Bubble. Thank you for being a friend, a mentor. I am one of your biggest fans, and I cannot wait to follow your journey with In the Bubble.
Congratulations and thank you.
Congratulations.
Happy anniversary and congratulations and thank you.
Congratulations, Andy, from all of us, the team here, me, James, Noah, Martine, and Catherine, Alex, Chrissy, and Ivan before us. It's been such an honor to work with you on this show and to help people. And obviously all these people too love you. So thank you.
Man, you rarely get me speechless. Boy. Are those people stupid? Oh man, wow. That's something to listen to. And nice of you guys to make that. Appreciate that.
All right, I'll let you off the hook and remind everybody Monday we're back. We're talking about should the U.S. government be involved in banning TikTok? What's happening? And we'll have some great guests on that and some other excellent shows here on In the Bubble. Year 4, it's going to be bigger and better than ever. Thanks again, Andy. Thanks, everybody, for listening. From everybody here on In the Bubble, we'll see you Monday.
Thank you for listening In the Bubble. We're a production of Lemonada Media. Martine Macias, Catherine Barnes, and Cal Sheely produce our show, and I love them dearly. Our mix is by Noah Smith and James Barber. They're awesome part of the team. Steve Nelson is the Vice President of Weekly Content. He is amazing. And of course, the ultimate big bosses, Jessica Cordova Kramer and Stephanie Whittleswax, and they are wonderful. They executive produced the show. Our theme was composed by Dan Millad and Oliver Hill, and additional music by Ivan Karyev. You can find out more about our show on social media at Laminata Media, where you can also get a transcript of the show. And you can find me on Post at A Slavitt or on a place called Twitter, still at A Slavitt. Follow In the Bubble wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free on Amazon Music with your Prime membership. And if you like what you heard today, email us, talk to us, tell your friends. We appreciate you so much. Talk to you next time.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people. And we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Last Day from Lemonada Media explores the moments that change us. Those times where you look back and say, whoa, one day I was myself and the next I wasn't. I'm Stephanie Whittleswax, and I have seen time and time again how sharing these stories can change lives. So, do you have a moment in your life that changed you, fundamentally and forever? What happened? How did you move through it? And how did you eventually start again? If you'd like to share your story, go to bit.ly/lastdaystories, bit.ly/lastdaystories. We can't wait to hear from you.